This episode is brought to you by HivePass. HivePass is the latest in membership management software that brings a radically different approach to how members join your organization, their experience as a member, and how you interact with them. Built by not only an app developer, but also a mountain biker, HivePass was made by a trail user for trail users. With an app-based platform, instant digital membership cards, ability to send push notifications to members, in-app trail status reports unique to your organization, HivePass is building the next generation of membership management software for your organization. Future additions to HivePass include an event system, automated custom trailhead signs, and much more. HivePass has been live in New Zealand and Australia for a few years, but just launched in Canada, and with this announcement, the United States. Over 50,000 trail users already use HivePass to support their local trail organization. HivePass is the world's first app-based membership management software built specifically for trail organizations. For all of the details, check out hivepass.app. That's www.hivepass.app. Or download the HivePass app today. You're listening to Frontlines, a podcast for the people that truly make mountain biking happen. Not the riders, racers, or product designers, but the builders, advocates, and the often forgotten board members of your local mountain bike trail association. I spend a lot of my time now in the advocacy realm, kind of focused on BC parks and less mountain biking and more kind of hiking, backpacking, camping, whether it's front country camping or back country camping. And it has made it difficult, I think, a little bit for this podcast and finding topics to discuss. And number one, I just want to thank everybody for being patient in between episodes. And I want to thank my sponsor as well, HivePass, for being patient as well. I do a lot of trail building still, but I'm less focused on kind of big picture within the organization and kind of working with youth on trail days. And that's really the focus of my mountain bike advocacy right now. But every once in a while, I get a chance to meet somebody or to cross paths or to hear about a program that really excites me. And I could probably release more episodes at a faster rate, but I know I wouldn't be as passionate about the discussions and the topics. And this episode is a great example of something that I'm very excited about and very passionate about. And so I'm excited to kind of share this discussion with you. Going forwards, I'm always looking for new episodes. And so as somebody that might not always have kind of their finger on the pulse these days in the mountain bike advocacy world, I do invite all of you to help share ideas, send me an email, send me a message on social media, share a link, whatever it is. If you see something really cool and you think that maybe there's a wonderful story or a wonderful discussion there, or something that this audience, this community of advocates would like to know about, please pass that along to me. But with that, I'm your host, Brent Hillier, and this is episode 97 of Frontlines. I am joined by Siobhan Fox. She's the founder and executive director of Recovery Rides. Hi, Siobhan. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Brent. Thanks for having me.
So what I wanted to start with is just tell us about Recovery Rides. What is it?
Recovery Rides is a nonprofit that's led by people with lived and living experience. So meaning people who have experience with substance use disorder and recovery. The idea is to connect individuals in various stages of recovery to the outdoors, primarily through mountain biking. And because of our own journey, both in working with people with substance use disorder and also as mountain bikers, we recognize that there are a lot of barriers to folks getting into the sport. And we hope to mitigate some of those barriers and make it sort of make both recovery experiences more equitable and also make the outdoors more equitable for folks who want to get out there.
Awesome. How do you, I want to know more about how this was started and how it's created, but how did, kind of what was your background to get you to creating an organization or program like this?
Well, I've been mountain biking for, I think, around like 15-ish years now. And for me, it was very much from the first time I tried it, which was I did a dirt series mountain bike camp as sort of my first intro to mountain biking. And I, at the end of that weekend, I wrote on their survey that the last question was, is there anything else you'd like to tell us? And I wrote, I have found my passion. And as a person who sort of grew up around musicians and artists, and, you know, I love music and I love art, but I'm not good at either of them. I really felt like as soon as I found mountain biking, it was like my thing. And it just did so many great things for my life over the years. And I did struggle with substance use disorder, alcohol use disorder over the years. And I attended a day program through Vancouver Coastal Health. I attended some things called SMART meetings, which are less known. They're more psychoeducational compared to AA. But really, mountain biking stayed with me through that whole time of many attempts at recovery, and having that passion and having that desire to be able to like go out, ride my bike, be good at it, not be hungover, not be in some sort of withdrawal. And that was really important to me, as well as having the community of people that I rode bikes with. Fast forward a little bit, the pandemic hit, I change careers, and I start working for a nonprofit just on the downtown east side in support of housing, and then moved into being an outreach worker, working with people who were dealing with substance use disorder as well. So spent 5 years on the front lines of that career. And then I ended up on leave for PTSD, I guess, or adjustment disorder, as they want to call it. And out of that, Recovery Rides was born, sort of looking at, you know, what's missing in the recovery world for folks. And, you know, for people that don't know, the recovery, even though we have like universal health care for other health items in BC, the recovery world is, there's a huge gap between what you get when you can pay and what you get when you're in government funded recovery. So somebody who goes to, for example, you know, a fancy private recovery center where they pay $30,000 a month, they may have access to what's called adventure therapy. But somebody who's going to like a government-funded program in the city, the best they might hope for is like a walk around Trout Lake Park or something like that. So the idea with Recovery Rides was to try to bridge that gap and offer an outreach service where we could actually pick people up from, whether it be a treatment center or sober living center or like a day program they're going to, provide access to the bikes, provide some coaching, and get people out on the trails and get that sort of therapeutic nature, community, adrenaline, all of that good stuff together for people that are, you know, working on their recovery, whatever that means to them.
And so when you started the program, kind of walk us through maybe the initial kind of, ooh, I think this would be a great idea, to how to actually make that happen and make it a reality to what it is right now.
Yeah. So the first time I actually thought of it was long, long before any action was taken. And it was probably back when I was dealing more with the early days of my own recovery. And then, you know, sort of maybe went on the back burner or just seemed like a bit of a pipe dream for a long time. And then, as I mentioned, I've been on leave. And with that, I've been, you know, out riding my bike as one does. And I was, you know, I was feeling antsy about not working, but also not feeling ready to go back to the role that I was in before I went on leave. And in the middle of a ride, it just sort of came to me. And I thought, you know, you've always thought about this program and how great it would be to connect people in recovery to riding. And like now's the time. And I finished the ride and I immediately texted my husband from the car. And I said, I think I'm going to start a nonprofit. And he was like, that's awesome. You should do it. And then I just started setting up meetings with everyone and anyone I knew who might have knowledge that they could share about how to make this a reality. And yeah, I just threw all my energy into it. And now we're here.
What were some of the initial challenges just kind of out of the gate?
I think that one of the things what isn't a challenge is that I'm very lucky that I had the time. Whereas a lot of people would be in a full-time job and then, you know, end of the day, you don't really have capacity to work on a passion project. So I did have the time to get things going. But I would say that money for anything is a challenge. So, you know, we've applied for a few grants, so we're still crossing our fingers and our toes on those. And we're about to start a fundraising campaign as well. We found a company called Charitable Impact that provides fundraising tools that we need, as well as helping connect us with what they call an incubator charity. So we're a registered nonprofit, but one of the issues in Canada, at least, is that when you can be a registered nonprofit, but you're not necessarily a registered charity, which allows you to give tax receipts to people. So if we want to get those bigger donations, we have to work with a charity who can help us out with that. And Charitable Impact is working on helping us with that. So although it's been, you know, things like that, maybe they're a challenge, but I do feel like they're all moving forward. And everybody I've talked to has been so supportive and so, you know, excited about the idea that I really think all of that's going to come together. It's just a matter of time. And, you know, we're very new. We're just about to launch our first pilot rides at the end of the month. So I think everything is moving along as it should so far.
Yeah, it's tough. I think, you know, all of us, our time is getting more and more restricted these days, as we're all having to, you know, work a little bit more to kind of make ends meet. And it always concerns me that, like, these types of initiatives and these types of programs are things that might suffer. And I think, you know, for all of us that are involved, whether it's with a trail organization or some sort of a nonprofit or organization that offers something within the cycling community, you know, when we kind of do the math of what we have capacity for, I'm always worried that, you know, these are kind of the things that a lot of us will say, I just don't have time to volunteer to do this, and it is a big concern for me going forwards, as I think it seems like life is getting a lot harder these days, especially financially. But carving out this time is really important. And, you know, that's something that I always try to do as well, is make sure that there's, you know, yes, you've got to cut certain things, but there's stuff that's just really, really important. And I think this program it sounds really special. I'm really excited about it. When we get out for these rides, like, what's kind of the first ride going to look like? You know, what walk us through kind of what this first event is going to be.
Well, one of the first things I did, as I mentioned earlier, like I reached out to everybody and anyone in my network and even outside of my network to sort of have meetings with and ask for help and talk about, you know, how to do this. Because, you know, in shocking news, I'm not an expert at starting nonprofits. But one of the people that I reached out to immediately is a longtime friend, the owner of Essential Cycles, Jacqueline. And she's already quite well known for, you know, working with the community and has been a longtime supporter of Color the Trails. And I asked her right off the bat if she was somebody that would be able to support us with bikes and coaching. And before I had even asked and had just pitched the idea, she just said, "What do you need?" So having somebody who, you know, has a rental fleet and also runs a coaching business has been instrumental in us sort of, you know, planning how that's going to go. And as I mentioned, you know, she has experience working with Color the Trails and has done the programming where setting folks up who have, you know, never been on a mountain bike ride before and taking them from just, you know, doing some basic skills, then maybe, you know, riding on a double track and then having people actually ride single track by the end of that first day. And so that's what we've talked about. The first ride for recovery rides is going to look quite similar to that, because the people are going to be people who have not mountain biked previously. We look to do 3 sessions with each group and then also offer like kind of a graduate program. So say people do 3 on mountain sessions with us, and then they, you know, they catch the bug and they're as, you know, passionate about mountain biking as I was after I tried it. Then we want to offer opportunities for them to continue to come out with us and also connect with each other and start riding, you know, so that it's not just a one and done, like here's mountain biking, you love it, but good luck doing it again. So no, that's not how we want to do it. And Jacqueline also has opportunities for folks who are part of our program to then purchase bikes at the end of the season, the rental fleet at a reduced rate compared to the general public and things like that. So we want to continue to lower those barriers for people to actually get into the sport after the initial 3 on mountain sessions.
On this podcast, we've talked a lot about the barriers for mountain biking, and you know, the topic comes up a lot of like, well, mountain bikes are expensive, and something that I've always kind of said and discussed on the show and just in conversations in general that I have with folks is that the mountain bikes that, you know, those diehard mountain bikers purchase are expensive, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not required to go mountain biking to have, you know, the most high end mountain bike that's out there. And I know for myself, working with the North Shore Mountain Bike Association, a big focus is making sure that we have accessible trails and trails that you can, you know, ride a lot of different types of bikes on. And so is that kind of barrier, or maybe that perception of that barrier, has that been a challenge at the very start?
I think so. And I think especially in the lower mainland, or, you know, even like Vancouver proper, I think that, you know, we see so many of like the best bikes, you know, if you think about standing in the Whistler Bike Park lineup, right? Everyone and anyone is there, and they're on the best of the best. And all it takes is a visit to, you know, a less, I would say maybe a less well-known bike park, or maybe go shuttling in a rural area, and you see people just shredding on older bikes or bikes that might be considered like less, you know, well-equipped by compared to somebody who re-ups and gets a brand new bike every year. So I do think that there is you know, a bit of a perception that you need just the highest end gear. But on the other hand, I think when people are getting into the sport for the first time, I really want them to have like the best experience. And so I think that really having access to, you know, kind of a premium rental fleet to start with is helpful. I mean, nothing's worse than seeing, you know, as sort of a stereotype, but you see like a couple out on the trail and one person trying to show the other person this sport that they love, but the person trying it for the first time is on a very dated piece of equipment that isn't doing what it's supposed to do. And as a result, they're not having a very good time. So I think that there's sort of like a balance to be had there and making sure that people have like the right thing to have a good time. And then also, I think that now, because of sort of the after COVID situation in the bike world, there are plenty of really high-end bikes for sale at a lower price than we're used to seeing. So hopefully some of our participants can take advantage of some of that used equipment out there.
Now, obviously, the folks that are going to participate, a lot of them are going to have maybe zero experience with mountain biking, but also the people that you're working with as you kind of help to get this nonprofit off the ground. There's probably a lot of non mountain bikers that you're working with on this project or discussing this project with. What's the general perception of mountain biking? Like, do you find that people are receptive, or is there kind of an understanding of maybe mountain bike culture that isn't true? What's the feeling from those non mountain bikers of like what mountain biking is or could be?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of both, right? A lot of people, you know, there's sort of this funny story that I've told a few people. One time I was sitting in my doctor's office and there was this book about ADHD. And just for anyone listening, I know you wouldn't know, but I have ADHD. And so anyway, I like pick up the book. I'm just like, it's sort of interesting. I look at it and it had this list and it was like questions to consider, like if you think you have ADHD. And I'm not joking. The very first question was, do you like bikes? So now I'm not saying that everybody who has ADHD likes bikes, but and I'm not saying that everybody who has ADHD has a substance use issue. But I will say that, you know, there's evidence out there that people, especially who have untreated ADHD, have a higher chance of having issues with substances, just because sometimes it can feel like quite uncomfortable to be in our bodies. And I would say that I've also met a lot of people who have struggled with substances who really love their bikes. So even though people might not have a history with mountain biking, they often have a history of loving their bikes. And so some people have thought like, ooh, mountain biking, I'd never be able to get into that. That's like a rich people's thing. But other people are like, oh, yeah, like mountain biking, I did that a little bit as a kid, or, oh, yeah, I've always wanted to try that. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag, but that's like part of our role, is to show people and explain to people that, you know, this is possible. That being said, it is a niche sport still, and not everybody who's in recovery is going to desire doing it. And that sort of goes back to what I was saying about us providing an outreach service. So, you know, there might not be six people all at the same treatment center that want to go, but if we pick up two and then pick up two from somewhere else and then, you know, pick up one somewhere else, all of a sudden we have a group.
I feel like in mountain biking, I think it's shifting, but I think when I think to, and skiing as well, like these types of activities, there's a strong kind of après culture. with mountain biking and with skiing, and along with that après culture is drinking and alcohol. And is that something that has come up in conversations with folks?
That's actually one of the first things that I considered when planning how the rides are going to go. We're instead of ignoring that, what we do is a sober après. And so I'm actually in the process of reaching out to some local kombucha makers, because that's often a beverage that a lot of people enjoy having at, even at a lot of the breweries nowadays. They serve kombucha on tap. And there's also, some sparkling water companies, as well as I've noticed these new sort of quote unquote healthier sodas. So sodas that have like maybe just 5% juice or something like that in them. And so we're in the process of reaching out to some local companies to see if they want to make a donation to our program so that we can have a little sober après together and build that sober community for people. We're not a abstinence only program, but like in the sense of if people are in recovery and they're still, let me just clarify what I mean by that. A lot of groups who provide recovery services, especially well-known ones like the 12-step groups, they're considered abstinence only. So that means that people can't consume any substances. Our program is not like that. We accept people who are in recovery, however they define that. So, a lot of people might be quitting something, but still maybe using cannabis or something has actually been shown to be more of an exit drug than a gateway drug, like it was sold to us as, like, oh no. Yeah. So things like that. However, the rides themselves, people will be expected to show up in a state where they're able to do the sport. And then we want to provide an environment afterwards where, we could drink some soda waters or some kombucha together, talk, share the stoke from the ride the same way that people would if they were having some beer, and let them get to know each other in a fun environment that isn't just 100% focused on their recovery, like a lot of the other things that they might be doing at a time in early or even like later recovery.
Yeah. It seems like a really interesting time in kind of addiction work, where it seems like there's a lot of people thinking a little bit outside the box. And, something that I've been looking at of late is my relationship to alcohol. And through the pandemic, that became a very toxic relationship, where I think previous it wasn't as much. It was kind of a substance that I use socially. It didn't define me. It wasn't a daily thing. And then all of a sudden, locked in my home, away from my communities. And the only thing kind of left to fill that time was, having a beer and watching old baseball games on YouTube, and not exactly a healthy lifestyle that I was previously living. And then coming out of that pandemic, realizing that, like, oh, well, this relationship has changed. But also recognizing that, as I did research on, what options were out there, that abstinence-based kind of process, it didn't feel right. But there wasn't a lot of resources. And so I've been learning a lot about these kind of other models. It's really nice to kind of see as we kind of look at, like, what options are out there. And I also think that, sometimes we have people who are really into the outdoors, kind of use the outdoors as like, this is all the antidepressants that you need, or this is like, and it's like, that's not necessarily true either. There is no one solution for everybody. And it's nice to hear that there's a dynamic outlook to this.
Yeah, I think nowadays there are more options than before. And I hear what you're saying about the pandemic. I think that that really, I was personally 6 months sober at when the pandemic hit. And it was incredibly challenging going through the stress of it, because I was previously an English as a second language teacher to international adults. And we went on Zoom within 24 hours of the lockdown, or the so-called lockdown. And then within a few months, the school that had existed in Vancouver for 30 years went bankrupt. And we didn't even like get a goodbye or anything like that. So going through the stress of that, transitioning into a new career, and then also seeing everybody having these like Zoom drinks, and then that quickly moved into everybody like drinking in the park, and you know, like, yeah, like drinking's fun. That's why people do it, right? It helps release stress. Like, I'm not here to like demonize alcohol if it works for people. It's just, I personally will just continue to ruin my life over and over again if I drink. So I ended up just really leaning heavily on my husband during that time. He also doesn't drink alcohol. And we would go for walks. And I would say, like, on this walk, can we like talk about some of the reasons why we are sober right now? Because I need to say the good reasons out loud. Otherwise, I'm going to be joining everybody in the park. But less about me, I did notice that since then, a lot of people have gotten into sort of a sober, curious thing, and that there's definitely like more beverages out there like that. And from a healthcare standpoint, most of like Vancouver Coastal Health programs and things like that are really like harm reduction based, and they're not trying to have this this black and white idea around substance use, where only abstinence only, and even no medication sometimes, and things like that. There's a lot more variety available, like you said, although I still think it could be better. I struggled very hard to find programming for myself that was not 12-step based.
Yeah, it seems like that is, if you get on Google and you start trying to look for help, you know, it's, that seems to be it. And you know, some of the things I've read about that is that there's no forgiveness in a program like that, in the sense that if you are sober for X amount of days, weeks, months, years, and you have a slip up, that you failed, and that failure, it becomes a reason to fully go back to substances. And that's not a supportive environment.
Totally. I mean, I think I do want to say that like anybody who's using 12 steps and it works for them, like that's awesome. And we totally are open to having anybody who's in 12 steps that want to use Recovery Rides as like an adjunct therapy. Totally welcome. For me personally, I think, yeah, that there's a few things that I find problematic about it. That being one of them, that you start all over again at zero, and it's like considered like coming back. But I also think that because 12-step programs are so pervasive, like in media, and they're like what you see in pop culture, movies, things like that, it's, you know, they have a very like moral lens around substance use. And I think that that really contributes to a lot of the stigma that exists with addiction. And I think, like, you know, there's campaigns out there that say things like stigma kills, but, you know, it's true. We're living in a toxic drug crisis right now. It's, you know, been called a public health emergency. We're now into the 10th year. 7 people are dying a day just in British Columbia. And so people using substances alone is how they die. And so having that stigma, having that shame, and then you're creating a way higher risk for overdose, relapse, all of that stuff. And I just think that there's a better way, you know, there's a better way, and that And we need to recognize, too, that not everybody who uses substances has a problem with substances, right? So although we are a recovery program, there's plenty of people out there who don't need recovery. And that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that's why it's really important that the people running the rides, like myself and anybody who works with us, really needs to be trauma informed. And I think that that's, like, you know, a word that gets thrown around a lot. But I think being truly trauma informed in your work is important when you're working with a population who has been through so much and that, you know, might not respond to things in the way that you would expect from the general public. And I think that's why it's important that we're a lived experience organization as well.
Yeah. What do you maybe expand on, like, expand on those two terms, trauma-informed and kind of a lived experience organization? Like, what do you mean by that?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of trainings nowadays about being trauma-informed. And I think people could access those if they're interested. But, you know, it comes down to understanding the nervous system and understanding how people don't always respond the way that we expect that they might. And that often if somebody's acting in a way that might just be considered negative in normal terms, it could be a trauma response, and understanding that that's not a personal thing, and helping noticing the signs so that you can, you know, potentially help somebody regulate, and knowing how to do that instead of adding fuel to the fire, so to speak. And so that's really important with me. I feel like I'm quite trauma informed and plan to provide some education around that for anybody that works with us. I have to do the other side of it and get my mountain bike coaching. So I'll be doing that in a couple, 12 days now, so that I can help bring those together by running our rides. And then in terms of the term lived experience, we say lived and living experience, meaning that in this context, the people working with us have experience with recovery and substance use, and may still, you know, access those services or still be dealing with recovery in some aspect of their lives. You know, there's a saying, nothing about us without us. And that's important for us at Recovery Rides.
You know, when I grew up in a very a very closed off community as a kid, and I moved to Vancouver fairly early into my kind of young adulthood, and I've been in Vancouver for 20 years, and I remember kind of first seeing the downtown east side when I first moved to Vancouver, and just being absolutely shocked at what I was seeing, that this type of environment existed in Canada. But it seems like these types of neighborhoods or these areas where you can see the drug crisis on the street exist everywhere. And as this opioid crisis goes in, as you mentioned, it's, you know, 10th year of being an emergency here in British Columbia. It seems like the downtown east side is not a unique environment, that these exist in every single city across North America at this point. You know, these programs are great, but how do we do more? And I know that, again, this happens all the time on this podcast, where we're like, my question to you is, tell me how we're going to fix the world.
It's no problem. I actually have plenty of ideas about how to fix the world, and specifically this problem. But yeah, I think that you're completely right that, like, the downtown east side is not unique. You know, there's neighborhoods like this all across North America. And I think, like, I'm happy to speak on it because I'm it's so upsetting to see the level of misinformation and actual intentional disinformation that's been used to really like demonize, you know, the drug user population. And I think like what we have right now is a toxic drug crisis. You know, like, first off, I would say that people have been using substances to alter their perceptions of reality for as long as humans have been being humans. So the idea that like prohibition or, you know, like just cracking down, having a fentanyl czar or any of these other ridiculous ideas is somehow going to make people stop dying is ridiculous. In fact, the reason why people are dying as much as they are is because of prohibition. So the more you crack down on things like this, like before, people used to be able to buy heroin. Contrary to popular belief, you can actually do heroin and also sort of do life. You know, there's plenty of people that use opiates and manage to keep a job and things like that. But nowadays, if you go to the downtown east side and you want to buy what's called down, you're only going to get fentanyl. And fentanyl is, you know, it's much stronger. The amount, it's unpredictable because this is an unregulated supply, right? So people don't know what they're getting. And that's, you know, sometimes people might even be buying stimulants and have no tolerance to opiates, and there might be opiates in it. You know, if you go to a liquor store, you know exactly what you're getting because that's a regulated supply. It says 5%, you know, 7%, 40%, and you can make your decisions. When people know what they're getting, they tend not to overdose. And you can really, like, going back to the analogy with alcohol, we can also see that when alcohol was made illegal, people continued to drink, right? They had their speakeasies, their moonshine, and then, you know, people started going blind because the alcohol wasn't regulated again. And the government realized, okay, this isn't working, and went back to having a legal regulated supply. So what we have right now is we have like a conservative backlash against harm reduction and against ideas like this of regulating the supply. And as a result, we have people believing that it's government safe supply that is causing this epidemic. And that it's just flat out not true. And it is so upsetting, you know, as somebody who cares passionately about this to hear, you know, just so much misinformation. So to sort of answer like what can be done, I think that changing the public perception is really important. So although Recovery Rides is way less on the front lines than my previous job of working on the downtown east side, it's trying to offer something, you know, for my own mental health in a something that feels a bit more like, sure, somebody, it doesn't solve the toxic drug crisis at all. But it does provide something fun for somebody to do who's trying to not use anymore. But if the general public wants to know, like, you know, what can I do to help, you know? Well, I think it's important that the government and the people in charge know what their constituents think. So I think that, you know, educating yourself about the fact that what we need is more housing. We need more housing in neighborhoods where folks can live, like supportive housing. And the mayor of Vancouver just recently, you know, passed a motion to not build more supportive housing in the downtown east side. So people need to let the government know that they do support the idea of a regulated supply, because unfortunately it seems like the people in charge are only reacting to those with the loudest voices, and those voices are not the compassionate voices, and they're not even the voices that are speaking about things that are evidence-based. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and this is something we see where, you know, the local trails that both of us ride on, Mount Frome, located in the district of North Vancouver, time and time again, we see supportive housing being rejected. And there are some new provincial laws where there can't be like these public input meetings at city council meetings for new housing as a way to kind of not silence people's opinions, but stop this like theater of people standing up at a city council meeting and villainizing folks that are in recovery, saying we don't want them in our neighborhood. We don't want them here.
Yeah.
Like, we get that they need housing, but we don't want them here.
Yeah. It's like a very classic NIMBYism. Yes. Yeah. And that's, I think, in some regards, that's why it's like so shocking to hear, you know, the motion to actually not even build supportive housing in the downtown east side, along with the plan to forcibly, they said not forcibly, but with the plan to displace Indigenous people from the downtown east side under the guise of returning them to their communities, despite the fact that, you know, many of the people living in the downtown east side, that is their home community, you know. I think that really like maintaining, just not letting the loudest, most negative voices win and staying educated about the topic on a local level, I think is really important, and trying to let the government know that those of us that support, you know, folks are also out there, and that support like an evidence-based approach to health and social issues, not an approach that's like fear-mongering and actually full of disinformation. Like that is one of the biggest issues I think we're facing just in general as a country right now, is this, how do you even start a conversation with somebody who just believes a different set of so-called facts than you? I really don't know the answer to that part, but...
Yeah. Well, this is what I'm really excited about with this program, is that I think, you know, there's obviously a huge benefit to these folks that are in recovery and coming out and riding the trails. And I think we're preaching to the choir of like how great mountain biking is when it comes to whoever's listening to this show. But I think what's really wonderful is that it creates an opportunity for broadening our community and talking about each of our lived experiences and just getting to know each other a little bit better and understanding each other and creating, you know, more advocates for all sorts of things, whether it's housing, recovery centers, safe supply, and just having this opportunity to be riding through the woods and seeing a group of folks out there who are experiencing mountain biking for the first time and being able to stop and chit chat and learn, which is wonderful.
I totally agree. And I think that's, you know, an important thing to note is just a final note, I guess, on the misinformation, is that there's a bit of an idea out there in British Columbia, and it's even perpetrated a little bit by the provincial government, with the idea of like involuntary treatment for folks. And I think that when they talk about putting people into treatment against their will, it does two things. Like, one, that's not really in line with like people's rights and freedoms, but also yeah. it gives the impression that there's a bunch of people out there that don't want to recover. And although of course there are people that probably aren't at a point where they've decided to seek recovery services, there are people out there waiting all the time to get into treatment, both into detox and then into like longer treatment. So although I can't fix that problem alone with recovery rides, I think it's important that the general public knows that people aren't out there needing to be forced into treatment. We need more treatment. And I hope that in our own little way, we can at least make treatment better for folks that are accessing it. And also, you know, just make it a little bit more equitable, because like I said, I don't think it's fair or just that you can pay to have the best of the best and then otherwise, you know, just get your walk around the park.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. How can people get in touch? How can they follow and see what you're doing?
Yeah, so on Instagram, we're recoveryrides.ca, same on TikTok. And our website is also recoveryrides.ca. We are going to be launching our first fundraising campaign really soon, so stay tuned for that. And we will be looking for volunteers and board members and general membership and all of those things in the next few months. So it'd be great if people could give us a follow on social media and stay tuned for opportunities to get more involved.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show and sharing this with us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
This episode of the podcast was recorded on the traditional territory of the Tsleil-Waututh, Squamish, Musqueam, and Stolo Nations. If you're curious to learn more about the traditional territory that you occupy and recreate on, then visit native-lands.ca. Like always, you can find the show on Facebook and Instagram at Frontlines MTB. You can also join the Facebook group at Advocates on the Frontlines of MTB. And you can send me an email or audio file at info@frontlines.com. Big thanks to Flan at HivePass for sponsoring this episode. And a huge thanks to Alexa, Jacob, and Drew for their continued support of this podcast. To become a Frontlines VIP member to receive early info about upcoming shows, you just need to support the show via PayPal. You can find a link to that in the show notes. In the show notes, you'll also find links to Recovery Rides, as well as a way to support them financially. Music, as always, is by Lee Rosevere. Production notes by Jennifer Pride. Artwork is created by Brandon Gallagher Watson and BGW Creative. And finally, I'm Brent Hillier. This is Frontlines. Thanks for listening, and happy trails.